From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Windshield Weepers by John Aiken. All that country undulates. It is like the movement of the conductor's baton in the Andante. You look away from the hillside you are standing on and see a procession of slow, gentle, orchard-covered folds of land, which seems to be turning a little sleepily to expose the longest possible stretch of flank to the warmth of the sun. The horizon is never very far away. Beyond it, out of sight, the true mountains begin, but their blue and snowy crags are hidden by the nearer ebb and flow. It was a warm, lazy time. Even though there were frosts at night, the mornings after the first haze that dispersed were mild with the stored heat of summer, and by 9:30 the dew was gone from the trampled orchard grass. At first, water cascaded off the apple boughs and down our shirt sleeves as we picked. Then the shirts dried. Then suddenly we were too hot as the sun moved around the shoulder of the hill, and the grass became pounced with a random design of clothes dropped as the wearers moved from one tree to another. Radio music spurted out, snatches of talk and laughter. The tractor moved tirelessly up and down the rows, collecting stacked trays of apples, leaving empties behind. The tall white triangular fruit picker's ladders flashed like pylons through the dappled green and rust of the apple trees. At night, in one's cabin, images of the day returned to closed eyelids, even brighter than reality. For the first fortnight I dreamed about trees and leaves and apples, the roughness of the branch, the palm-filling globe of the apple, picked with one quick upward thrust, the tilting sway of the ladder on hummocky ground. Then by degrees my dreams changed and began to deal with mountains, those unseen mountains over the edge of the rounded horizon. I pictured them sheathed in snow, hollowed by echoing caves, and split by ravines. Every night, I wandered among them searching fruitlessly for something unknown and tantalizing that always eluded me. In the evenings, after picking was done, I tried to paint my dreamscapes, but they came through blurred and uncertain, maddening me by their crudity, by the way in which they overlapped and obscured the truth. Oil was wrong, so was watercolor. Line was too insubstantial. I tried a woodcut. Mrs. Marcadeau had equipped the cabin with a princely supply of artist tools, and it came nearer, but was still unsatisfactory. What could be the answer? I became more and more preoccupied, almost unconscious of my surroundings all day. The flashing trees and the browning backs of the pickers as I wrestled with my problem. It was in such a state of mind that one night I went on gate duty. There was a perennial shortage of pickers, because Mrs. Marcadeau would employ none but personally selected applicants, and in these ability to pick apples ranked as a very minor qualification. Consequently, it was a standing instruction that no one who passed the initial test was to be turned away, day or night. Suitable transients, if they arrived after Mrs. Marcadeau had retired, were given a night's lodging and breakfast to strengthen them for the forthcoming interview. Gate duty did not actually mean that one sat by the gate. Merely a private circuit connected one's cabin with the milk and apple vending machine that stood by the highway. If somebody put a coin in the slot, this rang an alarm bell in the cabin and the circuit was opened up. At about 2 a.m., the alarm rang. I was not asleep. I had been wandering restlessly about my cabin, drinking black coffee and smoking. Sometimes I stared at my incomplete mountains, sometimes out of the window, at the moon-drenched orchards. The night was very quiet. We were about 150 miles from the nearest railway. Sometimes you could hear owls, sometimes just the thud of ripe apples falling. When the bell rang, I was glad of the distraction. I took a notebook and pencil and sat down, expectant. The tape recorder clicked on. I heard the machine go into its usual routine. "Good evening, stranger," Mrs. Marcondo's voice, nasal earnestness coming through the cordiality. "I hope you are enjoying our creamy milk. It is today's milking, from the famous Westover herd of purebred Jersey cows." "Thanks," a young voice replied guardedly. "Boy or girl?" "Too husky to say." "It'll do. Your apple," the machine pursued, "is the Westover Pearmain, across from Sterner, Concerto, and Bramley. Would you care for another? Pull the handle on the left, and a second apple will be delivered free." "Thanks again," the young voice said. Was there a trace of irony? "That's a mighty kind of you, Mr. Machine." "When you taste your apple," the machine said, "you will notice that the flavor is a blend of grape, honey, and citron. No other apple has this unique lyrical tang. Try a bite." The crunch of an apple being bitten came clearly through the transmitter. "Isn't that delicious?" the machine said. "Maybe. Maybe, Mr. Machine, but, you know, it seems like when you buy an apple, you buy it to taste like an apple. No? I can eat an orange some other time, or a grape. Still, I appreciate your thoughtfulness." "I wonder what takes you traveling at night, stranger," the machine said. "I guess that's my business, machine, old buddy," the voice answered. "Though it's kind of you to inquire. I wonder if you're looking for a bed for the night, or in need of a job. We can always employ apple pickers if they have the special qualifications required by Westover Enterprises." "And what qualifications would those be?" the young voice said cautiously. "You are a night voyager, stranger. Perhaps you're alone. Perhaps you prefer to avoid the common mass of humanity. I wonder if you're a poet or a painter. Or maybe you are a composer of music." "I'm afraid you're out of luck, machine feller," the young voice said, sounding amused. "I'm not any of those things." "Even if you are not a professional," the machine continued, unheeding, "is it possible that at some time or another you have written a poem, painted a picture, made up a song?" "You surely do have some crazy idea about what's necessary for apple picking," the voice remarked. "If your pickers have to be budding Beethovens or Botticellis, I suppose that explains why the flavor of your apples is all fired lyrical." "Think," the machine urged. "Take your time. If you have ever written a poem, perhaps you would care to recite it. When you are ready, press the handle on the right as an indication that you are about to begin." This had the effect of sounding a buzzer, which was a signal to the man on night duty to have his critical faculties in readiness. "Oh, all right," the young voice said with a hint of weariness. "I guess I walked about as far as I can make it tonight anyway. Wouldn't you say no to a bed and a place to hole up for a day or two? I have written a song, as it happens. Shut your eyes, machine feller, and take a deep breath." There was a thud as something was laid on the ground, then unexpectedly, a twang of guitar strings. The buzzer sounded, the guitar muttered out an odd little primitive tune, all on four notes, and the voice began to sing. "Make sure there's plenty of ice cubes. Make sure there's plenty of gin. Bring olives along to the mountainside before we're fastened in. And bring along the queen of hearts, and bring along the knave. There'll be many an hour to while away when we are in the cave. And hold me tight and warmly, oh, put your arms around, for the cold is bitter where we are going, so far beneath the ground." There was a long silence. Then I unclenched my numb fingers from the pencil I had been holding, opened my cabin door, and ran downhill through the majestic pattern of black and silver tree trunks to the orchard gate. "Well," the young voice was saying dryly, "you seem at a loss, Mr. Machine. Does that earn me a bet ticket?" I came around the corner of the vending machine and stopped abruptly. The girl turned and saw me. "Hi, brother," she said. "Are you the owner of this one-armed mouthpiece? I was wondering who made the next move. Well, do I qualify?" "Oh, yes," I said, "you qualify. Would you like to come with me?" "Nothing I'd like better." She hitched her guitar onto her back again. She was wearing a plaid shirt and what looked like gaudy red and greens, but the moonlight made it impossible to be certain of colors over jeans. Besides the guitar, she carried only a small canvas bag, laced around the neck with string. She was small and stockily built, but walked with long strides, easily keeping up as I led the way, at a quick pace, back to my cabin. It was strictly forbidden for girls to enter men's cabins after 4 p.m. Apparently, Mrs. Markendoe could not conceive of immorality before that hour, and I ought to have taken her straight to the empty reception cabin, but I was curious about her. "What would have happened if I hadn't qualified?" the girl asked, kicking an apple out of her path. It bounced, throwing up a black spurt of icy dew. "I should have pressed the button and the machine would have gone into its B routine. Thanks for your interest and your recital. Sorry you haven't quite made the grade. Best of luck on your journey. Farewell, Voyager." "So, it rested with you whether I was in or not?" "It rested with me, but only for tonight because I'm on duty. I don't own the place." I held the door for her, and she stepped into my cabin. It was comfortable, if not tidy. A log fire smoldered on the hearth, and the floor was covered with some kind of folk weef matting that Mrs. Markendoe had specifically made for her at cut rates by poor Indians and lands afar. I put more coffee in the percolator and asked her if she'd like to eat. She shook her head. "Thanks, your tutti-frutti apples have done me fine." She squatted down by the hearth and warmed her hands. "Who does own the place, then? And where do you come in?" "Oh, I'm just one of the pickers. My name's Taylor."
"Taylor what? Or what Taylor?"
"Taylor Samuel."
"Mine's Sanchi."
In the dim glow of the lamp, I saw that she was a little older than I thought. Outside, she seemed about 17, but now I reckon she might be in her early 20s. She had straight hair tied back and an air of solemn inquiry.
"Who's the boss?" she asked.
"Mrs. Markendoe. She owns all the land around here."
"Why is she so sold on poets and painters?"
"Well," I said, thinking it sounded a little less mad in the moonlit small hours than at any other time, "she has this belief that sooner or later, if she hunts hard enough, she'll find the reincarnation of Coleridge."
"For Pete's sake, why does she want to do that?"
"You mean the guy who wrote The Ancient Mariner?"
"That's right.
We did it when I was a kid at school. Something about an albatross. I always remember one bit," she said dreamily, staring into the fire. "Like one that on a lonesome road doth walk in fear and dread. And something, something turneth not his head, because he knows a frightful fiend doth close behind them tread." She glanced back over her shoulder. I put another log on the fire, and a flame leaped up, illuminating my pictures stacked against the wall.
"You paint these?"
"Yes," I passed her a cup of coffee. "Coleridge didn't only write The Ancient Mariner. He wrote another poem called Kubla Khan."
"And so?"
"He never finished it. He woke up from a drug trance and wrote half of it down, and then a person from Porlock came knocking at the door and broke his train of thought. When the person had gone, he couldn't remember what he'd been going to say next." Sanchi had slipped off the soaked canvas shoes she had been wearing. She wiggled her bare toes in the warmth of the fire. Her feet were hard and supple and calloused as she went barefoot more often than not.
"I remember now," she said sleepily. "Coleridge was a junkie, wasn't he? It's a mug's game, though. You get so you can't coordinate. My grandma used to smoke cactus. She was half Indian. She brought me up. On her good days, it really lit her. I used to listen to her for hours. What sort of things? Oh, stories, songs, what she called her messages. But the bad days got worse and worse. I had to stay with her all the time because she was scared of things coming after her. I was happy for her when she died. She got into the old Ford one day and drove over a cliff. So tell me more about this Markando dame. Why does she think Coleridge is going to be born again? Is she nuts or something? I don't think so. She's just got this one fixed idea. Most people have at least one, don't they? I guess, maybe. Grandma certainly did. She had an idea about windshield weepers. What were they? Sign of death, she said. When someone was going to die, or when something bad was going to happen, she'd hear him sobbing and weeping as she drove along in her old car, sobbing and weeping around the windshield. She foretold plenty deaths that way. People used to say she was a witch, and I guess they were right. In the end, she said the windshield weepers were wailing for her death, and she might as well go. So she tied him into a little bag and gave it to me. What happened to Mrs. Markando? She lost her husband in an air crash. That shook her loose from life. So she bought this place. She's very rich and runs it to provide jobs for hard-up young poets and painters. You do a bit of work, and in return, you get your food and bedding and all the materials you need. Sounds okay. For a few minutes, Sanchi sat nibbling the tassel of her little bag and staring into the fire. I began to have the impression, more and more strongly, that she was afraid of something, that only half, or less than half, of her attention was given to me and Mrs. Markando. What was it, back there on the long moonlit road, that was so occupying her mind that kept pulling her eye uneasily to the door? Do you think she'll let me stay? She roused herself at length to say. It's nice and quiet here, off the beaten track. I remembered what she'd said to the machine. A place to hole up for a day or two. Why was she so anxious to hide? I guess she will. I like that song you sang. Have you any others? Some. A few. I made up myself. Lots my grandma used to sing. She rose and stretched, picked up her guitar, ran an idle thumb over the strings. I like your pictures, too, she remarked, strolling over to look at them. They remind me. Of what? Of where I was raised, way down in the mountains. Way down in the mountains, she sang. Of South Carolina. Whistling at the ink and pushing the pen along. Seen something else, Sanchi. She sang another song. Out of a forsaken maid on Bramble Mountain, sad and haunting enough to make your heart falter in its beat. Then, filled with compunction, I said, I suppose I ought to take her to her cabin. She ought to be getting some sleep. No, I'd rather stay here a while, she said. I guess I'm not so sleepy. And I'm no great shakes at sleeping in the dark. Her eyes started toward a door, and she brought them firmly back. Tell me some more about this Kubla Khan, she said. Have you got the poem handy? I had Coleridge's collected poems, and I fetched them out. Read it aloud, why don't you, she said. Mind if I take off my shirt and dry it? It was pretty dank and misty back there along the road. She took off both shirt and jeans, hung them matter-of-factly over the back of a chair, and curled up with her head on a cushion. The mood of the night was by now so far removed from reality that I did not feel surprised at finding myself reading Kubla Khan aloud to a naked girl by a blazing fire. It seemed merely odd that I had never done so before. A savage place as holy and enchanted as ever beneath a waning mood was haunted by a woman wailing for her demon lover. Sanchi made a slight movement. I stopped reading. Were you going to say something? Nope. But I waited, and she said with a slight effort. Of course, it might have been the other way around. What might have been the other way around? Coleridge might have been writing about himself and his demon girl, who went away and left him with his poem only half finished. Perhaps, I hadn't thought of that. What were you really going to say, Sanchi?
Nothing else.
She looked up at me innocently. She had found my comb and was combing her fine straight hair out in a fan, so that its darkness was fringed with gold in the firelight.
"Why do you keep looking at the door? Are you scared of something?"
She held my eyes with a show of bravado for a moment. "I'm not afraid of anything," she boasted. Then she hid her face in her hands, strands of hair tangled in her fingers.
"That's not true.
Well, you know, it isn't. I'm afraid. I'm afraid of him."
"Of him? Who? Who frightens you?"
"He comes out tonight, you see," she whispered.
"Out?
Of prison. He's a guy I used to be with. I think I know. He'll be after me again. Well, he'll be angry with me, and he scares me to death."
"What's his name?"
"Goliath." Curiously, as she said the name, I had a vision of a face, dark and low-browed and dark-skinned, with the strength and ferocity and sorrow of the big apes. It hung in the darkness between me and the girl for a moment, and then receded into distance.
"But he won't find you here, Sanchi," I said. "After all, he can't get in, can he? Unless he's a poet or a painter."
Her face unfroze at that, and she began to laugh, a little hysterically.
"No, of course you're right, he can't get in. That's a joke, isn't it? Poor old Goliath. He can't even answer the questions. He's too dumb. He can't get in."
"That's true, you see," she said, instantly sobering.
"What's true, Sanchi?"
"That he's dumb, literally. He can't speak. Not now." A silence, heavy with unspoken words, lay between us for a moment, and then she added in a low voice,
"Of course he could get in if he wanted to. Goliath could get in anywhere.
He'd have to ring the bell anyway. We'd hear him. How's he coming? Walk? Hitch? Car?"
"He drives."
"You'd hear the car. You'd have time to hide."
"I guess so, but she sounded unconvinced. Never mind, forget it. Read me the rest of the poem.
For he on honeydew hath fed and drunk the milk of paradise."
"That's what my grandma used to say. She had a song that told the same thing. The song about the far mountains."
"Sing it." She played a soft chord. As soon as she began to sing, I knew I had heard the song before. While half my brain was acknowledging this, wondering where I had heard it, the other half had discovered with lightning certainty what was wrong with my pictures and how it could be put right. The song died away unfinished. Sanchi's eyes were riveted on the door, which was opening slowly. A wedge of shadow slid across the floor. It crept on till it reached Sanchi's bare foot.
"So," said Mrs. Markendale's voice,
"this is how you repay my hospitality? With vice and fornication?" She stepped into the room. She was a formidable figure, not tall, but gray and gothic, gimlet-eyed, her nose a flying buttress, every iron curl netted into place.
"No, that's not so, Mrs. Markendale," I protested. "We've been doing nothing wrong. Sanchi wanted to dry her clothes, and I've been reading her Kubla Khan."
"What sort of fool do you take me for, young man? I am not quite so innocent as you suppose. I can only ask you to pack your things and leave immediately. I'm appalled. Appalled to think what I've been cherishing under my...
"Apron strings," I suggested angrily.
"Look, all right, Mrs. Markendale, I'll go if I must. Though I promise you no impropriety of any kind has taken place. But let Sanchi stay. Wait till you've heard her sing. You'll see what I mean. And she's scared. She needs somewhere to hide."
"Let that hussy stay? Listen to her sing? Likely idea. Clear off," she snapped at Sanchi, who, quite unembarrassed, was putting on her shirt.
"I hate to think of my orchard harboring such things as you."
Okay, Sanchi said pacifically.
Keep your hair on, you poor old nutcracker. I'm not an apple weevil. I'm not going to steal your fruit. Thanks for the rest and the chat, anyway, she said to me. Wait, Sanchi, I said. I've got to pack all my stuff into the jeep. You might as well hang on and get a ride. She'll wait outside my gate, if at all, Mrs. Markando said, breathing very forcibly up and down her nostrils. Well, thanks, no. I guess I won't wait. I'd better not ride with you, Sanchi said. She slung the guitar over her back and gave me a little nod, formal but friendly. Don't leave this, Mrs. Markando whisked up the small canvas bag distastefully by one string and pushed it toward Sanchi, who drew breath in a sharp hiss. The bag pulled open slightly, but nothing spilled out, and Mrs. Markando, pushing it into Sanchi's hand, insultingly held the door open and ushered her into the night. The sound of their feet died away over the crisp grass. In the distance, I heard a car change gear on the long slope of road leading up to the orchard gate. Was it my imagination? Or did I catch, somewhere far off, a faint sound of wailing? The new day was gray and muffled in thick mist when Mrs. Markado reappeared and grimly supervised the final tidying out of my cabin. Goodbye, Mrs. Markando. Thanks for your help. I'm sorry it ended like this. Goodbye, young man. So am I. I'm leaving you my paintings as a gift. I think I know what I'm trying to do now. But did I? Stuffing socks and handkerchiefs into a kit bag, I wondered if that half-formed vision would stay with me, or had I to begin again from the bottom. If I had words, I might be able to describe what I'd seen, but then, I'm not a poet. I'm not interested in your painting, Mr. Taylor. I'm afraid, now. Isn't that just like a woman? I thought, trudging down to the shed where the jeep lived. My feet left black snail tracks in the gray rime. Perhaps, I thought, if I drove fast, I might catch up with Sanchi. Old Tom, the regular gateman, had already hobbled on duty. He opened up, and I stopped to say goodbye. Sad doings down the valley yonder, he said, gesturing south. Motor crash down the bottom of Helter Skelter Hill. Anyone hurt? I asked with an aching premonition. Killed. Young gal. Stranger in these parts. Was she carrying a guitar? He looked at me blankly. I couldn't say. No, that I couldn't say. Car was a proper wreck. What about the driver? Driver? There wasn't but her in the car. Nobody else. 5 miles down the road, I came to the scene of the crash. Some bits of twisted metal, some skid marks on the road. A few locals were still standing thoughtfully by the wreckage. Funny she wasn't in the driver's seat, one of them said, evidently for the 20th time. And what made her skid? Weren't no reason to skid there. The remains of a guitar lay on the grass, but there was no sign of a small canvas bag. I drove on. There was nothing else to do. A damsel with a dulcimer in a vision once I saw. It was an Abyssinian maid, and on her dulcimer she played, singing of Mount Abora.